from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, well-known journalist and author Peggy Orenstein joins us to talk about her new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. After interviewing more than 70 women between the ages of 15 and 20, Orenstein has learned some surprising and disturbing things about the way young women engage in sex, including how they often repress their own needs and wants. In Girls and Sex, Orenstein tackles the question, when so much has changed for girls in the public realm, why hasn't more changed in the private one? We'll talk with the Berkeley-based best-selling author after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. In her new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape, Peggy Orenstein asks whether young women today have more influence, more control, more freedom to shape their sexual encounters. In an age of women closing the wage gap, graduating from college at higher rates than men, and laws that mandate affirmative consent to sex, or only yes means yes, are girls better able to assert their needs and wants in the bedroom? What she learns is that largely they aren't. And in this hour forum, we explore why. And I want to just say that, yes, we will be talking about sex for the next hour. So some listeners might be sensitive to this content or might find it inappropriate for children. Well, with that, Peggy Orenstein, welcome back to Forum.
Thanks for having me, Mina.
Thank you for being here. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Though the book is sort of troubling, right? The sexual experiences of many of the nearly 100 young women that you interviewed.
Yeah.
You describe a world where there's little control, little joy in sexual encounters for a lot of these girls, and that half of them felt coerced in some way into sex, if not raped. Does this kind of sum up sort of the environment that you were seeing repeated?
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting. I've been writing about girls now for 20 years, and it's been really exciting to see the positive changes that have happened in girls' lives. You know, they're more able to speak out, they're talking in classrooms, they're more political. But there's this silence when it comes to their personal lives. There's this disconnect. And as a parent, as well as a writer.
Your daughter's 12.
My daughter is 12, yeah. And I think there's a way that, you know, you kind of don't want to know. You just, like, want to hide your head in the sand. But I felt like, you know, ignorance and fear are really bad parenting strategies. And so what I hoped to do with this book was to go out and talk to girls and bring what they had to say back so that we can better support them to have experiences that are ethical and reciprocal and enjoyable and safe.
And so one of the reasons that you highlighted as to why it is hard for these young girls to have agency in this private sphere of sexual encounters is because of what you call the tyranny of hot. Can you describe that?
You know, I was just actually watching this video today by Rachel Bloom, who's Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Don't go watch it right now because that would be wrong. But after the show is over, that was Put Yourself First in a Sexy Way for Him. And I thought it completely summed up what I was trying to say about the tyranny of the hot, which is that, you know, hot is a very superficial, commercialized idea of sexy and attractive. And whereas in a previous generation, we protested that, now it's much more complicated. And girls also are sold it as power and as self-confidence. So a girl, for instance, showed me a picture of herself in, you know, the obligatory tiny crop top and tiny skirt and said, I'm so proud of my body and I never feel more liberated than when I'm dressed in skimpy clothing. And then we talked a little bit further and she said, but, you know, if she gained a little weight, she wouldn't be able to wear the skimpy clothing anymore because she'd be worried that somebody would call her what she said, you know, was the fat girl. And you have to ask, I mean, talking about, you know, why are girls wearing this clothing now? It's not it. It's saying to girls, well, so who gets to be proud of what body, under which circumstances, and why? And is it really liberating if humiliation lurks right around the corner?
So who is really making the rules?
Who is making the rules, yeah, that you're playing by?
Yeah, and it was interesting because you mentioned, you know, also that you wanted to it's not that you're uncomfortable so much with girls being able to wear whatever they want to wear, right? And
right.
This was sort of a fine line for you, right, where you were trying to say, you know, I don't want it to be used as, which it often is, right, that girls have a responsibility to stop other people from doing things to them, from ogling them or assaulting them based on what they wear.
That's what's so complicated. You know, on one hand, yeah, it is not girls' responsibility to – it's boys' responsibility not to, you know, be staring. It's not – one girl says, look, you know – after she's told to cover up by a teacher, every day, it doesn't matter if I'm shrouded from head to toe in burlap, somebody makes a comment on my butt, and that's distracting for me. It's not my job to keep boys from being distracted, you know, and that's absolutely true. And yet there's something Orwellian about, you know, the right to bear arms and bear midriffs and, you know, and all of that. It's almost like two legs good, four legs bad. So it was really complicated to try to work that out. And I argued a lot with girls about it. And that was one of the things that was sort of fun about writing this book, was letting them have their voice and arguing and sometimes revealing generation gaps that, you know, were kind of humiliating for me to realize.
Yeah, you did include girls pushing back on
Absolutely.
You. What were some of the most, you know, what were those pushbacks that struck you?
One of the things that we really tussled over, I mean, what I'm, you know, always thinking is, I feel like the culture reduces girls to their bodies. I feel like it tells them over and over and over and over that how they look to other people is more important than how they feel in their bodies to themselves.
Well, we've got a, you know, controversy now between two presidential candidates' wives, Melania Trump and Heidi Cruz, where essentially they've been reduced to their appearance, to
Absolutely.
Their appeal.
And girls see that all the time. And so I'm, you know, arguing about that. And so one of the things that we would argue about a lot was pop culture icons. So, you know, they would see Nicki Minaj as transgressive and I saw her as buying in. You know, they would see, you know, I got into an argument with one girl about, you know, why do you think it's transgressive when Lena Dunham is naked but not when Nicki Minaj is? And we sort of went round and round on that. And I just, you know, I let her have her say in the book because I'm not trying to convince girls that I'm right. I'm trying to let people know how girls are thinking and what the complicated issues are for them.
Yeah, I read one girl who said that she saw these women like Nicki Minaj and Miley Cyrus, for example, sort of rejecting the shackles of respectable behavior that girls are supposed to follow, right?
Right. And these girls, you know, the girls that I talked to were really bright girls. You know, they were feminist. They were strong. They bandied about words like slut shaming and, you know, they could do all that. And yet it was still true that their confidence kind of came off with their clothes.
So, yeah, talk a little bit about that. So how does this tyranny of hot translate into, you know, less agency and sexual encounters?
It is not about how you feel in your body. I mean, one of the things, there was just recently that kerfuffle with Kim Kardashian on internet. You're looking blank.
Because there are so many kerfuffles.
Listeners, you're looking.
Are you referring to?
Mina's going, what? This one was on International Women's Day where she was sending nude selfies out.
Right.
And the question was, is Kim a feminist or is Kim a slut? And, you know, I think neither one of those is the case. But one of the things that she said in her I don't know, defense or whatever you want to say, is I'm expressing my sexuality. And I thought, really? Because I think expressing your sexuality is about understanding your body's responses, being able to articulate your needs, wants, desires, and limits, being able to communicate with a partner. It is not displaying the body. And in our culture, we have gotten confused between what's sexualized and what's sexual.
So it's almost like the girls are performing in almost a product sort of way, as opposed to actually being the subject of their own encounter.
Absolutely. And there's so much in the culture that is pushing them towards seeing femininity and seeing sexuality as a performance and as a product to put out, whether it's social media. I mean, that's a big one now. Every girl knows that you get more likes with a bikini shot than you will in a parka. You know, there's just this pressure to craft yourself for this external representation rather than understand how you feel inside. And then when they go into their sexual encounters, also because of the silence, which I'm sure that we're about to talk about around their bodies and their pleasure, there's just this complete inequality. It's all about the appearance of sexy.
We're talking with Peggy Orenstein. She is an author and journalist. Her new book is Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She's also the author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Girly Girl Culture. One of the things that you call out in terms of this performance of sexuality is pornography and how it seeped into the lives of these young girls. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It seeped into their lives both through them and also through their male partners for heterosexual girls. And one of the things that we see in research is that 60% of kids in, for instance, one large-scale study of college students say that they consult porn in part as an instruction manual. And, you know, even as they say they know it's about as realistic as pro wrestling, you know, and that its depictions of women are about as realistic as Real Housewives probably. And so that in itself creates expectations about what happens in the bedroom. And one of the things that would, you know, on the more, I guess, somewhat benign end, you know, it obviously creates expectations about bodies. But girls would say to me all the time, my boyfriend wants to know why I don't make noises like porn stars when we have sex. And I got so annoyed, not with them, but with the fact that they had to ask that question was out there, that I dropped my journalistic remove, you know, and I would say, it's a movie. They have to have a soundtrack, you know, otherwise it would be a silent movie. They weren't kind of aware that that was not the way that they were supposed to be. And on the more extreme end, there's been a real uptick in teenagers of anal sex. And this is happening, you know, with kids where girls have never masturbated, they've never had an orgasm by themselves, they've never had an orgasm with a partner, but they're doing this. And what research shows is that it's boys who are pushing for anal sex, that they're not doing it as a way to be intimate with a partner, but they're doing it as a competition with other boys, that they know their partner's going to have to be convinced or coerced, and that they think their partner can be, and that it's going to be painful. And the girls say that indeed it is. And yet they blame, both boys and girls, blame that on the girls, saying that the girls are, the words in the research are, you know, naive, flawed, unable to relax.
Wow. So just another example here of how girls are having a difficult time negotiating their role. How were you able to find these girls? We talked about how hard it is to the silence around girls. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking specifically about the silence behind their entitlement to enjoyment. But but how were you able to get them to even open up to you in the first place?
Yeah. You know, when you say the entitlement to enjoy it, the way that I always think about it is that girls feel entitled to engage in sex now, but not necessarily entitled to enjoy it. And I found them all kinds of different ways, you know. I found them through high school teachers. I found them when I would speak on college campuses. I found them when they would write to me because they'd read other work that I've written. Friends of friends, you know, and it kind of rolled. But I'll tell you, the first couple interviews that I did, they did not go well because I think that I was too shockable. I think that I didn't expect what I got.
You mean you were reacting too much to what
reacting.
They were initially saying?
Yeah,
and
I was reacting.
Off.
And the first two interviews that I did, those girls, I tried to do follow-ups with them. They would never respond to an email or a text again. And that was a real learning experience for me. I had to really think about how I was betraying my biases, what I was thinking about, what I wanted out, you know, what I wanted for girls out of these interviews. And I think in some ways that mirrors parents' perspectives, you know, that you, and I was hoping with this book that if you read it or if your daughter reads it, that it gives you a chance to kind of collect yourself, think about it, and, you know, start those conversations in a way that is less judgmental, less shockable, less reactive.
And you mentioned in the beginning that this group of women that you talked to, about how many were they again? Because I've seen two numbers. I've seen nearly 100 and more than 70.
Yeah, I think more than 70 is probably closer. Yeah.
Okay. And so you say at the beginning that this does not reflect, you know, everyone's experience or even necessarily a broad demographic, that you mostly spoke with upper middle class girls, white girls.
And upper middle class girls. there actually was a pretty broad range ethnically.
Okay.
Most were white.
Describe the demographic.
It was upper middle class, pretty broad range in terms of religious background. They were college or college bound. And I really wanted to talk to that group because that is the group that we think about as leaning in and being empowered and having all the opportunity. And so to look at the disconnect in their life, there was no way that parents in particular and teachers and advocates of girls could look at what they were saying and find some reason why it didn't apply to them and their girls and their daughters.
Well, we've got a comment from Brian who writes, 70 subjects is not a sample. Having the interviewer select the subjects introduces bias. Perhaps if the young women are concentrated geographically and belong to a certain culture, one can speak of getting a reliable cross-section of a particular group. Otherwise, these are anecdotes.
I think what you have is a combination in this book of qualitative research backed by hundreds of studies. And the book goes back and forth between the voices of the girls and studies on sexuality that date back, you know, 20, 30 years.
Well, let me invite our listeners to continue commenting. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, post comments on Facebook or Twitter, or on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can also join the conversation by giving us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. So, Peggy Orenstein, what do we do to try to make it easier to talk about, you know, what sex is and what sexuality is by incorporating, you know, this idea of enjoyment and agency?
Yeah. I mean, one thing that really struck me was looking at our culture versus Holland. Because in Holland...
Right, you found some answers in the Dutch.
I sure did. My basic response is move to the Netherlands. but in studies that compare American girls and Dutch girls, college girls that are very, you know, similar demographics, they find that Dutch girls go into... their early sexual experience is more positive. They are sexually active later. They have fewer partners. They express more enjoyment. They have more control, more agency. They can talk to their partners. Everything that we want. And the American girls express just the opposite. And one of the biggest differences is that whereas Americans, particularly American parents, take a kind of harm reduction approach to sex, we talk about risk and we talk about danger, Dutch parents balance that by talking about the pleasures and the joys of sex. And that is something that we are almost completely silent about when it comes to girls.
Well, and... what about the state of our sex education? Are there examples where this is happening that we can use as models?
Or? Yeah, there's actually some great models in the Bay Area. And in the last chapter of the book, I go into classrooms with Karis Dennison, who's a youth advocate in Marin. And, you know, one of the things that was really important to me in that chapter was that it's boys and girls working these things out together because, you know, we don't want to forget boys in the equation, obviously. And there was a moment in this classroom where they were talking about the baseball metaphor, you know, rounding the bases.
Getting to first
sex.
Base.
Yeah.
Base.
And this kind of vertical idea of sex that really doesn't serve girls very well, honestly. And one of the boys suddenly paused and said, I never thought about it before, but in baseball, there's winners and there's losers. So who's supposed to be the loser? Mm. And Karis looked at me and I looked at her and we kind of raised our eyebrows and I just thought, bingo. Now that boy carries that thought into every encounter he goes into from now on. And that is an amazing thing.
Hussam asks, and this is along those lines, so how can we educate the parents to educate their boys at an early age on how to treat women and girls respectfully, as if these women and girls are their siblings or their mothers? that might work against them, but yes, we understand what he's saying.
I absolutely think that that's true, and I think it is not enough anymore to say to boys, you know, don't get a girl pregnant. And that's the end of the sex education. And there's these shifting definitions of rape that you better watch out for. We have to talk to girls about – I mean to boys, excuse me, and girls, but to boys about coercion. We have to talk more explicitly. One of the things that I found was that when we talk about sex, we tend to be talking about intercourse. And kids are not just doing that. You know, we need to broaden our definition so that we're talking about things like oral sex, because kids think of oral sex as not sex. They think of oral sex as not a big deal, as long as it's going female to male. And so that opens the door to a lot of coercive behavior, because as one girl said to me, you know, the boys that I know, they know you're not supposed to force a girl to have intercourse, but they don't know you're not supposed to do that with oral sex. And there was a lot of non-reciprocal oral sex going on out there.
And I think you were also saying that some of the examples that they were seeing in pornography played a role in that, that it was sort of reducing both the intercourse and the oral sex experience as something that precedes a deep, meaningful relationship. Like that was almost like much lighter than an actual intimate connection with another person.
Yeah, that's kind of the hookup culture. But I just, you know, I want to say that one thing that I found really useful with girls in talking about the oral sex issue was I would say, look, what if boys always said to you, you were together, you know, go get me a glass of water out of the kitchen. Every time you're together, go get me a glass of water out of the kitchen. Go get me a glass of water out of the kitchen. And they never offered you a glass of water. They never offered to get you one. Or if they did, it was like, you want me to get you a glass of water? You know, and you would never stand for it. And the girls would just crack up. They would laugh and say, I never thought about it that way. And say, well, maybe you should. Maybe you should think about the fact that you're more insulted by somebody asking you to go get a glass of water repeatedly than somebody expecting that you're going to give them non-reciprocal oral sex repeatedly.
Yeah, it was interesting. There was a girl who mentioned that, you know, having it done to her was considered something that you would do at a much later stage in the relationship,
yeah,
where there was more intimacy.
More intimacy, more trust. I mean, it was a weird kind of combination with the way girls felt about their genitals that was at once that they were kind of sacred and also that they were kind of icky. And both of those things made them reluctant, not just boys reluctant, to receive oral sex. And I was always really interested in kind of inversion behaviors. So, for instance, girls would say when I would ask them about masturbation, "Oh no, I have a boyfriend to do that." But then they would tell me that boys would tell them that they didn't want manual sex because they could do that themselves. So it was like, you know, like a flip side. And the same thing with oral sex. You know, a lot of girls would talk about, and I'm sure a lot of adult women remember this, the shoulder push. You know, how boys would kind of silently push on their shoulders to try to get them lower. And sorry, Mina's making faces at me. But girls on the flip side would do the opposite. They would try to lift boys from under the arms if they started drifting south so that they could get away from that area and get away from embarrassment or shame.
It's interesting. There was a point where a girl said, well, if he's satisfied, then I'm satisfied.
Yeah, we have to get back to that.
Yeah. Well, as you can probably hear, we're talking about sex. Peggy Orenstein has written a new book, Girls and Sex, about navigating the complicated landscape. Again, these issues may be sensitive to some listeners and it may not be appropriate to children. So I do want to put that disclaimer out once again. But if you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, post comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on Facebook or Twitter. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're speaking with Peggy Orenstein about her new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She's also the author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Girly Girl Culture. She speaks actually at several places in the Bay Area coming up. I want to give you a quick sense of where those are. On April 7th, she'll be at the Berkeley School with Mrs. Dalloway's bookstore. On April 19th, at Book Passage in Corte Madera. And on April 28th, at Books, Inc. in San Francisco. And all of those events are at 7 o'clock. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation, or I did just before the break, and we've gotten a lot of responses. So let me go straight to calls. Laura in Fremont. Hi, Laura.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. There's just a couple of things I wanted to mention because this talk is just so important to me and really relevant to what's going on in my life. I feel it's really hard. I'm 20 years old, and it's really hard to feel that sense of sexy or hot, kind of what you guys are mentioning, without really objectifying yourself. And I found it that, you know, with my partner, even from 5 years, there are times that it's really hard to just feel attractive no matter, you know, what it is you really do. And then also, I've noticed in school and in the workplace, you can really switch on your sexuality and it changes the what your worth is. Like me just dyeing my hair, I noticed I got so much more attention from men and other people, and it wasn't really something I wanted. And it made me almost feel like I made a change, not for myself, but for these other people. Mm. And it almost feels like you can feed into this, like being the sex object or not. And there's a lot of times where I have to choose, do I just want to do what I want to do, or is that going to make me an object?
Yeah.
And is that going to make me feel like I'm not really supporting, you know, women and what I stand for?
Laura, thanks so much for sharing that.
Yeah, Laura, that I mean, you sound like so. All I can say to you is that those sentiments are really shared. I mean, what you just said was very much what I heard from girls, that they're constantly shifting from subject to object, sometimes without wanting to, sometimes back and forth, you know, in a matter of minutes or hours or days. And it is very confusing and complicated. And again, it's all about, you know, how you appear to others rather than your body. And I wanted to go back, Mina, if I could, to what we were saying right before the break, which was about sexual satisfaction. And I wanted to, you know, we don't talk to girls. We don't identify their body parts. We don't identify their anatomy. So we start with you know, I read that when parents are much more likely to name everything on their baby boy than they are on their baby girl. And their baby girl, they go right from belly button to knees. And certainly they don't talk about the clitoris. Certainly they don't talk about the vulva. And then girls go into puberty education. And you see the inside, you know, that thing that looks like a steer with the uterus, and the ovaries. Mm-hmm. You get, you know, for boys, you get erections and ejaculations. For girls, you get periods and unwanted pregnancy. You know, unsurprisingly, fewer than half of girls have ever masturbated between the ages of 14 and 17. And then they go into their sexual encounters, and we expect them to have a sense of entitlement and agency.
You know, we have a question from Tony in San Leandro that I think is along these lines of teaching kids. Tony, go ahead.
Hi. First, I want to say thank you. I've been teaching sex ed for close to 20 years. And I'm going into a school next week where I have the children of same-sex couples. I have several gender nonconforming students, and I meet with the 4th through the 8th grades. So much of what you're saying is so useful for all of those populations. I do want to say that I've been talking about the vulva for a long time and the clitoris as the woman's organ of sexual pleasure, and basically saying that sex should be a pleasurable activity for both people. But I'd like you to talk just a little bit more about this. Where is it? I know that oral sex comes up for me in terms of questions in the 7th grade. And I start getting anal sex questions around the 8th grade. Is there anything more you can tell me about girls' experiences as well as boys' experiences? I think some boys, as you were saying, feel maybe entitled to have that if they're not going to get intercourse, that they're entitled to some other kind of sex. I do include all of those as sex. I don't just talk about intercourse.
So, you mean, Tony, you'd like some tips in terms of how to talk about to boys who are sort of expecting that?
Yes.
I will say that the kids that I talk to are a bit older than the kids that you're talking to, but I think that having these larger conversations about entitlement, about reciprocity, about egalitarianism, and about decision-making. You know, I think that one of the things that Karis does a lot is talk to young people about, she uses the phrase, I get this wrong all the time, I want to make sure I get it right, feel, think, and act. You know, how you feel about something, how you want to think about it, what you want to have happen, and being able to make decisions and make them well in those moments and have plans in advance. This is really more for the girls, I think, but having, you know, having plans in advance about what you want to have happen, what the options are, what you can do. And after an experience, looking back and thinking, gee, so how did that go? what happened that I wanted to happen, what happened that I didn't want to happen, and almost treating, she kind of jokes that, you know, life is like an English essay, and you can always look back and reflect and revise and think about your behavior and do something different next time instead of just going, oh gosh, that sucked, and moving on and doing it again.
Well, Tony, thanks for the call. We're also getting some pushback, and I'd like to get your reactions to two of these comments. Rick writes, I'm confused. Girls spend lots of time prepping to look gorgeous and sexy, including wearing paint-on yoga pants and low-cut blouses, but boys are not supposed to look? This sounds like discrimination against normal male behavior. Our society beats down male behavior, and then girls like my daughters are bored by these neutered guys. Then Dan writes, I'm so tired of the conversation that blames boys and men for girls and women's sexual behaviors and choices. As a child, I was sexually molested, and growing up, I was always out of sync with girls. Adolescence was difficult for me because the girls always saw me as slow and unsure of myself. I know this is totally uncivilized of me to ask, but in writing her books, did the author ever consider that boys have their own challenges growing up male and not just as it relates to females?
Absolutely, and that's somebody else's book to write, and I hope that they do. And I say very clearly at the beginning of the book, especially about these issues of sexual harassment in hallways and in schools, not all men, right? Hashtag not all men, but every single girl. Every single girl that I talked to had had experience being catcalled, being touched, being harassed in school, being harassed on the street. So obviously, there are many men and boys who are terrific allies of young women. But that does not negate what's going on in young women's lives. And again, one of the reasons that I drive to, at the end of the book, a co-educational classroom with Karis, is that I do think that boys are part of this discussion. I do think that those kinds of questions need to come up and be worked out between boys and girls. And I also just want to add that this is, you know, we're talking now, of course, in a heterosexual relationships, and we can talk about
other relationships. I want to talk about that, actually, because also Toni was bringing up that she also teaches a sex ed class, you know, to gay and transgender students as well. And I guess I'm wondering if there were examples in these couples that provided – were these dynamics the same in same-sex couples or
– No. It was really interesting. So there's – I have one chapter in particular that is really focusing on LGBTQ kids. And the girls in that chapter would talk about how going off the script, going off the kind of heterosexual script, gave them opportunity. And at one point I was talking to one of the girls about the idea of virginity, because one of the things I challenge in the book pretty strongly is the validity of virginity and continuing to define virginity as vaginal intercourse and the implications of that for girls. And she I said, so you're gay, you've never had intercourse with a guy, you've had partners, do you think you're a virgin? And she said, you know, I had to look that up on the internet, when is a gay girl not a virgin? And I said, what did they say? And she said, you know, there's no real answer. And I said, well, what do you think? And she said, well, and you know, she kind of tossed it around a little, and she said, you know, I think maybe you're not a virgin anymore when you have your first orgasm with a partner. And I thought, okay, I'm not naive. I know I'm not going to dismantle virginity single-handedly here, but what if just for a minute we thought about it that way? What if just for a minute, how that would shift our understanding of sexuality, and particularly of female sexuality?
Well, Summer tweets, thank you, Peggy. There's too much pressure for females to be sexual. When will we give each other permission to not be sexual? And it's not that you're saying don't be
– right.
You're not talking about – draw the distinction between sexuality, mm-hmm. right?
And sexualization.
Yes, sexualization.
You know, I guess I have always – in both Cinderella, My Daughter, and in Girls and Sex, I'm really wrestling a lot with ideas of marketing and the way that sexuality and sexiness is marketed to women and imposed on women, and how, you know, sex appeal becomes all appeal. And no matter what else you are, you have to be sexy. You have to portray – perform, you know, sexual availability. That is one set of things. The other set of things is understanding is sexuality, which is something that is cultivated from within. It's how we feel in our bodies. It's understanding our own capacity for pleasure. It's being able to, again, articulate our needs, wants, desires, limits, and have those respected. It's being able to communicate with a partner, whether that encounter lasts 10 minutes or 10 years, you know? It is that sort of thing that that I want to work on with girls and help them to have more pleasurable, more ethical, more responsible, more reciprocal experiences.
Well, speaking of Cinderella Ate My Daughter, do you feel like the pretty princess culture that's marketed to girls is connected to girls' difficulty in, you know, negotiating their sexual entitlement or for their pleasure in sexual encounters?
No. No, just kidding. Sorry, I just had to do that. You looked so earnest. Yes, absolutely. You know, I mean, pretty princess culture, the pink box that girls are put in, again, it's always telling them from the get-go that how they look is more important than how they feel and that pleasing others is more important than knowing how to please themselves, that being desirable is more important than their own desire.
Well, that's sort of hard to hear because, I mean, is this what we have to look forward to? I mean, our kids' generation, you know, inundated with,
yeah.
with it.
But you know what? One of the things that I really felt when Cinderella Ate My Daughter came out was people would say to me, you know, but how are we going to change this? This is never going to change. But I really believe, you know, but it has. It really has. In the years since that book has come out, more people have sort of stood up and said, you know, I've had it with this stuff. And it's forced Disney to change to a degree. I mean, you know, the characters' eyes are still bigger than their wrists. But, you know, there has been change. There's a lot of alternative culture. And I think of it, I think of these issues, these in the book, I talk about intimate justice, and I hope that we'll get to that, too. But I think about these personal issues, these personal as political issues, sort of the way, I guess, that I think about the food movement, which in the Bay Area, you know, is a really great analogy because it really took books like Michael Pollan's books to take something that was sort of fringy and marginal. And yeah, not everything has changed. Not everywhere has changed. There's still work to do. But there has been major change because of the opening up of those conversations.
And let's go to Joshua in Oakland. Hi, Joshua.
Hi. Thank you for coming on and having this conversation. My question is, you know, as a young 20-something male, I want to make this conversation about me. So how can I, you know, date young 20-something women and kind of participate in this thesis, you know, without being patronizing or controlling or manipulating, you know, the pretty princess thing or even sexual revolution, you know, without manipulating or, you know, kind of exerting my will onto that partnership?
Joshua, thanks.
Oh, I think even the fact that you're asking that question basically gives you the answer. I mean, it sounds like you're a really thoughtful, well-meaning young man, and that is the kind, you know, and I think that the boys at the end of the book are really working with those ideas, too. They're really thinking about how to change this. One of the great analogies that I talk about in the book that I got from another sex educator is sex is like a pizza. You know, rather than the rounding the bases thing, and boy, you can take this metaphor very far. So let's just take it. But if you think, okay, sometimes we feel like eating pizza, maybe sometimes we don't. But if you decide you're going to eat the pizza and you go out with your friend to eat the pizza, you have this conversation like, what do we want on our pizza? Oh, you like pepperoni? I'm not so big on pepperoni. Maybe we can split it in half. Maybe we'll have pepperoni this time and mushrooms next time. You know, and it's something, and we both are invested in each other's enjoyment of the pizza. And that is a much better metaphor, stretch it however you want, for thinking about sex than this vertical rounding the bases, one person dominating another person metaphor. So have a pizza, Josh.
Judy writes, I find it offensive that teenage and college-age females who are sexually active are being called girls instead of women. This is something that men do that is condescending and contributes to keeping women from knowing and claiming their rights in relationships. Why did you title this Girls and Sex? You talked with 15 to 20-year-olds?
Yeah, I talked with 15 to 20-year-olds, so some of them actually are legally girls. You know, that's really interesting, and I struggled with that, too, because when I was in college, I remember going to school the very first day of college and saying something, you know, about girls, and everybody whipped around and went, women, we're women in college, you know. But now young women call themselves girls at that age. So I was kind of going with how they refer to themselves.
There's also the HBO show called
Girls. Yeah.
Why are they doing that? Have you figured out why that's happening?
I don't know.
Speaking of Lena Dunham, you've mentioned her as an example of someone challenging some of these cultural expectations.
Yes, and that was one of the things that I would argue with girls about was whether, you know, if Lena Dunham, I could say Lena Dunham was challenging, but, you know, Nicki Minaj wasn't or whatever, but Lena Dunham is a normal-bodied person, and she's taking her normal body and displaying it in public as a way to critique what we expect to see and what we expect of ourselves. And I just, you know, I think that one of my, and with sex too, she's portrays it as very real and raw. In her first movie, Tiny Furniture, which was before Girls, there's this sex scene. And I remember watching this movie and it's just sex scene in like a, it's like a metal tube and a loading dock. She's finally having sex with the object of her affection. And it's just dismal and grim and gritty and unfortunate. And she looks like sort of resigned at the end. And he says goodbye and he's texting while he's saying goodbye. And but it was really real. Whereas in Hollywood, what you would see is two people ripping off each other's clothes. Everything would be seamless. Everything would be perfect, you know, and it would look wonderful. And I appreciate that she shows the truth of young girls' lives.
And let's go to Kate in San Francisco. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks so much for taking the call. I think this is such an important discussion. I think one thing that I just came to mind is we were talking about kind of men's perspectives of women and men's opinions. And I think another thing that I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on is, what about women? I mean, I feel like women have certain expectations for how thin other women should look, how attractive other women should look, and how do we kind of have that discussion as women to even change our own perspectives on what we expect from our, you know, our friends, our colleagues, our, you know, the other women in our lives.
Absolutely. Kate, we police ourselves. We monitor ourselves. You know, one thing, social media has put a lot more pressure on that. And girls tend to, it's interesting with studies of selfies, girls tend to feel good about selfies that they put up, but they feel bad about selfies that others put up of them. I guess they're not selfies then, but pictures that they're in with others right. in them. And the more girls look at other people's pictures on social media, the more depressed they apparently get. I mean, that's linked to bad feelings about their own body because they're constantly comparing themselves to these other people's perfect lives and these other people's perfect pictures. And there was a study that looked at 1,500 social media profiles of girls. And it found that 1,499 of them, and I really, they don't say what that other one was. I'm very curious about that one, but portrayed a girl who, you know, was pretty, popular, went to parties, had a certain number of Red Cup pictures, was interested. It was like the same ideal, interested in shopping, boys, and pop culture. And yet when they talked to girls in focus groups about those profiles, girls were incredibly critical of other girls' profiles. So the very thing they needed to do in order to get likes and be popular, they were criticizing in one another.
Well, a listener writes, it's not teen boys who make the tyranny of hot. It's capitalism, and specifically the grown men who make its decisions. Hollywood movies, television shows, porn, advertising, sports, everything. Until American adults start to openly challenge the dictates of hyper-free market capitalism and reflect in their own personal role in capitulating it, we won't get very far trying to get teenagers to challenge the tyranny of hot.
Sounds good.
Caitlin writes, the conversation is bringing tears to my eyes. As a nearly 35-year-old woman, I never thought about how much all of this applies to me and how I've been ignoring my own sexual needs and comfort levels for basically my entire sexual life. I plan to read this book for myself and as the mother of a preteen, for my daughter, so that I can help guide her toward a more healthy and enjoyable sex life than I've experienced. I thank you sincerely.
Oh,
were you hearing this? Actually, you know, Maria asked, so what are the takeaways for grown women on how to own their sexuality and be comfortable with their bodies? Have you been hearing this? Or I guess this book hasn't been out
the
for
book
very
is
much,
actually
very
coming
long.
Out Tuesday.
Yeah.
So it's so
oh,
this is
right.
new. Yeah. So
just reviews have been out. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's that's really interesting. And I kind of am starting to hear this. Yeah. And I do think, I mean, I think in all of these areas of change of social justice for women, whether you're talking about being assertive in the workplace or assertive in your relationship at home, a lot of it is learning to do this ourselves so that we can communicate it to our daughters, or at least educating ourselves to the point where we can communicate with our daughters and try to make it better for both of us. You know, whether you're talking about weight, whether you're talking about making your life better, more equitable in the home, all of those things. And with sexuality, the term that really stuck with me and that I talk about a lot in Girls and Sex was intimate justice. And the ways that our most intimate relationships are social justice issues that are about equity, that are about violence, that are about economic disparity. And you have to ask.
The personal is political.
The personal. Yeah, right, right. And what could be more personal and what could be more political than these power dynamics? So you have to ask, you know, who is entitled to engage sexually? Who is entitled to enjoy that? Who is the primary beneficiary of an experience? How do you find define good enough for each partner? And one of the things we see with sexual satisfaction with young women is that they measure it differently than young men. So young women are more likely to say, college-age women, if he's happy, I'm happy. If he has an orgasm, I'm satisfied. So they measure their own satisfaction by the yardstick of their partner's pleasure, whereas young men are more likely to say, if I had an orgasm, I'm happy. So they measure it by their own pleasure.
Let's go to Roberto in San Francisco. Hi, Roberto.
Yes. What really concerns me, I'm facing with the same dilemma with my daughter and talking to her about sexual activity and growing up. But what I hear about this particular topic in this lady, you know, she's painting the whole picture with like a cream puff cupcake. But she's not talking about sexually transmitted diseases. They're out there. And if young people are not educated on sexual transmitted diseases, we really should not be having this conversation at all.
Roberto, thanks for making that point. Peggy Orenstein, you did focus more on the emotional effects of sex and sexual encounters in this book than you did, say, on STDs or unintended pregnancies. Was that deliberate?
Yeah, that was deliberate, because I think that when we do have comprehensive sex ed in America, we do tend to use a harm reduction approach. We talk about STIs, we talk about unwanted pregnancy, and we talk about that to the exclusion of talking about balancing that out with how to balance the joys and pleasures with the risks and dangers. And that is one of the reasons why other countries, where they do talk about both, do a better job with their kids. That said, I do talk about STIs in the book. And one of the things, when I was saying earlier that we need to broaden our definition of sex to include oral sex when we talk to kids, oral sex, kids believe that that's totally safe. And that is why we have seen a huge spike in STIs among teenagers, even though the rates of intercourse haven't changed.
Roberto, thanks for that point. Max writes, how much of our refusal to tell girls the whole truth comes from misguided urges to protect them?
Oh,
you bring
yeah.
this up in mm-hmm. the book. You talk about, you know, sort of these dances of like, you know, people who are fathers saying, you know, my daughter is somebody worth waiting for. And, you know.
Right. I think, yeah, there's some way that we feel like if we don't tell girls the truth about sex, that it's going to protect them, whereas the truth is over and over that you see in research that the more they know, the more information they have, the more empowered they feel in their own bodies, the more likely they are to make choices that benefit them rather than choices for their partner. I do go to a purity ball in the book. I go to the South to a purity ball, which is where daughters pledge that they will remain virgins until, or pure, I guess they say, until they enter into a biblical marriage. And the thing about that, though, was that you would expect somebody like me to go to a purity ball and just slam it. You know, the abstinence-only people, just slam it. That would have been really easy to do. But I found myself having another reaction as well, which was that even though I completely disagreed with what these parents were saying to their daughters, the fathers were having a conversation with their daughters about their expectations and their values and their love of their daughters and all of this around their sexuality. And the alternative seemed to be, in more liberal communities, silence. And at best, fathers would make lame jokes. And so I was really moved to see fathers becoming closer to their daughters at adolescence, even though I wish that they were having a different conversation.
Well, can you, you know, in speaking of that, can we talk about things that are encouraging that you found in the way that teen girls approach sex?
Yeah, and I think that the
teen women.
Teen women, teen girls, whatever you want to say. You know, one of the girls talked to me about how she grew over time. And I think that this was just terrific. She, you know, she at first she started saying, well, you know, I come from a family of strong women and my mother's strong and my grandmother's a firecracker and I'm a strong woman. And then she told me this kind of string of again, you know, kind of too young, unreciprocated sexual encounters. And I said, why? And she said, well, you know, we're socialized to be meek and deferential as women. And I said, but you just said you're a strong woman. What's that about? And she said, yeah, I didn't know that applied to sex, but I'll tell you. She was a little older. She was going into her junior year of college. And she said, I'm realizing that I'm not doing anybody any favors by, you know, not by faking orgasm or by not demanding more in my sexual encounters or by not thinking about what I want. Instead, now I feel like I have to stand up for myself, not only for myself, but for all the other girls as well. So I really loved that.
Well, Peggy Orenstein, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today.
Oh my gosh, that was so fast. Thank you. That was really fun. Thanks, Mina.
Peggy Orenstein, journalist and author. Her new book is Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She's also the author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Girly Girl Culture. She speaks April 7th at the Berkeley School with Mrs. Dalloway's Bookstore, on April 19th at Book Passage in Corte Madera, and on April 28th at Books, Inc. in San Francisco if you want to continue the conversation with her. And thank you to our listeners for sharing their stories and insights. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Joanne Wallace is our executive producer. Our interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadad. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.